I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Today, an update on efforts to keep Ebola from spreading, as the nurse Nina Pham, the first person to contract the disease in the U.S., undergoes treatment at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda. Also, it's been a half century since the publication of Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are, and a traveling exhibit celebrating the beloved children's book and its author has arrived at the Enoch Pratt Tree Library in Baltimore. We'll hear about that. Plus, Midday film critic Christopher Llewellyn Reed reviews three films, including one that promotes the radical notion that there are other ideas worth rallying around than patriotism and fear. Midday Friday begins after the news from NPR. And welcome to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again, everyone, for joining us. Today, an update on the efforts to keep Ebola from spreading. We'll get to that first. And I want to recap some of the major stories in the last 24 hours or so regarding Ebola. Two Ebola-stricken nurses from Dallas have been sent to special biocontainment units for treatment. Nina Pham to the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda and Amber Vinson to Emory University Hospital in Atlanta. As you just heard on NPR News, President Obama has named an Ebola czar. We'll talk about that in a minute. Yesterday, a congressional subcommittee held a hearing on the handling of the Ebola cases and hospital protocols against the spread of the disease by the Centers for Disease Control. And briefly yesterday, in the Port of Baltimore, dock workers refused to work on a ship that was headed for West Africa. The New York Times reported today that an employee of Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital, who may have had contact with specimens of the disease, had left the United States aboard a cruise ship. The employee and a traveling partner, who were not identified by name, had agreed to remain isolated in a cabin aboard that vessel, according to the State Department. And out of an abundance of caution, efforts were underway to repatriate them. A physician aboard the cruise ship had said the employee was in good health. We're joined now by David Willman. Again, David Willman, reporter for the Los Angeles Times and part of a team of reporters for the LA Times who have been covering this story. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Dan.
Let's talk a little bit about the Ebola czar, this appointment by President Obama just a little while ago, Ron Klain.
Yes, indeed. Well, Ron Klain is a very seasoned player in Washington. Just quick background, went to Georgetown University, Harvard Law, held a prominent position on Capitol Hill, I believe, with the Senate Judiciary Committee, and ultimately, clerked for then-Supreme Court Justice Byron White, went on to be Chief of Staff to Vice President Gore, was very central to then-presidential candidate Gore's fight over the vote count in Florida, as you'll recall, that mm-hmm. ended up going George W. Bush's way. And then Ron Klain came back to government as chief of staff to Joe Biden. So Ron Klain is a lawyer by training, very deeply steeped in how Washington works. And, we'll have to listen to see what the president has to say. But I think we can infer from it that he, Ron Klain, is expected to probably improve the sort of total government approach that might be needed here with the government response to Ebola.
Improve it and also improve the messaging about the government response to Ebola.
Very well could be.
Yeah. Hey, in the last, couple of days or so, just following social media, listening to my listeners, reading email from readers and listeners, I told you this in an email before the show. I'm hearing people say that the media is overreacting. The media is contributing to an hysteria over Ebola. And I would just like to address that for a moment and get your perspective on it. Mine is that, I think the press is doing a pretty good job of covering a story and trying to provide the best information that they have that's possible. I don't know what goes on other talk shows. I can't speak to that. But in terms of reporting, what I see from the L.A. Times, New York Times, Washington Post, my own newspaper, The Sun, what I hear on NPR, it's pretty straightforward, and I think the press has done a pretty good job without sounding hysterical. But, you know, I'm in the press, so I'm maybe,
right,
I'm maybe a little defensive. So.
Well, I think we both have to acknowledge, you know, where we sit on this. But I would agree with you that those well-known media organizations, I think, have done a pretty darn good job of identifying what is going on with this outbreak, with this epidemic. The Centers for Disease Control, the World Health Organization, I mean, they have pointed out accurately that this is history's worst ever epidemic of Ebola. Now, when we talk about total media, you're talking about, I don't have to tell your listeners, you know, a very broad spectrum. If someone is listening to cable or looking at cable, I would also add, I think CNN has done quite a vigilant job of being on top of it. If you're on 24 hours, have some things maybe been said that are a little bit in excess here and there? Probably so. But, you know, on this question of it's really a tough balance, not only for the media, but for those who are in public health. And it brings me back to the extensive back and forth interview I had actually by email with a fellow named Nick Zwinkels, who is a frontline physician who was treating Ebola patients in Sierra Leone, who had to shut down his clinic, his hospital in Sierra Leone about 2 or 3 weeks ago because four of his five nurses died of Ebola. He had other cases, you know, that came in, that patients who they weren't able to identify as having Ebola. They thought they had other conditions, and they were quite infectious, and it was a horrific situation. And so in my back and forth with Dr. Zwinkels, you know, he was so pained, and he said, look, he said, you know, I'm really torn here about getting the information out versus, you know, sowing panic. His direct quote, which we used, was, quote, "This outbreak is completely out of control, and the only way to stop it is to find every case, isolate them, and trace their contacts." But anyhow, that is very much plays in my head when I look at the coverage and go about doing my own work.
And there's this high mortality rate with Ebola. Now, albeit, you know, this we're talking about West Africa.
Right.
Officials in this country at the CDC, at the White House, have insisted that, you know, a wider outbreak in the United States is unlikely because American hospitals can isolate and care any infected patients, which is an element that's missing in West Africa and those primarily three countries there. But, you know, we had a patient in a hospital, and that patient died, and two medical workers contracted the disease in a hospital. So, I mean, that raises concern that if it can't be isolated and contained to a hospital, that we, you know, that we could see a further outbreak. I think maybe that's why people are concerned.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, my sense from doing reporting on this is that, you know, the big advantage the United States has in not facing certainly an imminent epidemic of Ebola is that we don't have that many original cases here. We, to date, are aware of one confirmed case, a fellow who came over here who did not become symptomatic until 5 days after he'd arrived in Dallas. But so far as our hospitals being able to contain it, that, I think, has been demonstrated to be, shall we say, unproven, to say the least. I mean, this is a very, very infectious virus and very difficult to contain. And there's a high mortality rate of healthcare workers in the affected West African countries who have been killed trying to, in their courageous effort to treat patients, or compassion to treat patients. So very, very tough situation, and that's why the policy choices, you know, again, going back to my sensibility as a reporter, is to shine a light and find out the extent to which our policies here in the United States are based on data as opposed to wishful thinking. One just quick add to that. You know, Dr. Frieden of the CDC, Tom Frieden, and other surrogates of the administration had been going out there. They're not saying this anymore. As of 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, a month ago, saying, first of all, highly unlikely we would ever have a case in the United States. But if we got it here, any hospital in the United States modern hospital that can do isolation with any infectious patient of any sort can handle an Ebola patient. And I don't think there's a great deal of confidence in that conclusion anymore, and it's fascinating that one of the nurses, the Nina Pham, who was infected by Thomas Duncan in Dallas, was, as everyone knows now, was transported last night up to the National Institutes of Health Clinical Center here in Bethesda, Maryland.
Yes, and Amber Vinson, now at Emory University, Emory
Correct.
And Bethesda, NIH Bethesda, two of the four facilities that are, you know, biocontainment facilities that can handle these cases.
With very limited beds.
Yes.
So, you know, it's you just hope that that there aren't very many more cases that have to be dealt with, because it's extremely, it exhausts the system, and that doesn't even get into the hundreds of people that have to be contacted and then be subjected to some form of monitoring. Just these two flights that Nurse Amber Vinson took recently from Dallas to Cleveland and back, you know, I think we're now talking about 400 or more passengers on Frontier Airlines that are being contacted. I mean, that's incredibly laborious to do that.
And let me ask you this, David Willman, LA Times, our guest David Willman. Republican lawmakers and some Democrats are calling for the administration to just ban all travel passenger airlines from Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea. Those are the three countries at the center of this. And I mean, I read Dr. Frieden's response to that and President Obama's response to that. And I don't know about those responses. I don't know if they're very convincing to American people who hear this idea, you know, of a travel ban, and leaders say, well, it's not necessary,
right,
without a really good explanation. Do you understand why they feel it's not necessary?
Well, I think I've heard the administration's position on that. There was a hearing, by the way, yesterday in the House, which, like most hearings in the House, when you have over a dozen people trying to ask questions, can be quite
yeah,
frustrating to those of us who would like a more organized and efficient effort at getting at knowable facts.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what we know. We know that, and this is according to Tom Frieden and other administration officials who have the data in front of them, have said this, have confirmed this, that we have essentially 150 people a day traveling into the United States who originated in either Liberia, Sierra Leone, or Guinea. That adds up to 1,050 a week who are coming into this country. We know that Ebola has an incubation period, that is, a person can be exposed to Ebola and not become showing symptoms or be infectious with it for up to 21 days. I think the sweet spot of that is probably 8 to 12 days, but it's up to 21 days. Is the conventional wisdom. So that means that even if people are honest at the point of origin and they're honest when they land at Dulles or Newark or JFK, et cetera, that when they're asked, have you been exposed to anyone who had Ebola, et cetera, if they answer honestly and even if they don't take Tylenol to hide a fever, they could be, in fact, carrying Ebola virus and show up with it here. That is possible. So that is known. Now, what the administration says and some folks outside say is that if travel is severely restricted or banned into the United States from these point of origin countries, that this will somehow obstruct the relief efforts. I think what so that raises the question: Does the United States government have the capacity, or the leadership, or the will to put together a coalition of airlift to make sure that, hey, we're going to double down on relief efforts? You know, all the doctors, nurses, personnel that are helping, we're going to make sure they have charter flights, get on military transports, you name it. The thing that one little thing that came up at yesterday's hearing, and it's repeated elsewhere, that comes from the administration is another reason for opposing a travel ban. And this was actually reflected in the last paragraph of today's New York Times editorial on this, although it wasn't attributed to the administration, but it's spot on with what the administration has actually been saying about this back channel, and that is, quote, the danger is that if other nations followed an American ban with bans of their own, economies in West Africa would be crippled, unquote. Now, this was characterized at yesterday's hearing as the fledgling democracies of West Africa. that seems to be a little bit different than a public health approach.
David, so, we got to go, but thank you for doing that so briefly and quickly and succinctly. Thank you very much. And I appreciate you being on the show this week to help us with this story. We'll be in touch again.
Sounds good, Dan.
Yep. David Willman from the LA Times keeping us up to date on Ebola developments. Midday continues in just a moment. First, a brief reminder that Midday can only exist because of WYPR members. My senior producer, Nikki Gamer, is here to tell you how to show your support. And welcome back to Midday Friday. Dan Roderick's here. The night Max wore his wolf suit and made mischief of one kind and another. His mother called him Wild Thing, and Max said, "I'll eat you up." So he was sent to bed without eating anything. And so it begins, Max's wild rumpus in Where the Wild Things Are by Maurice Sendak. Throughout his 60-year career, Maurice Sendak illustrated or wrote more than 100 picture books. But Where the Wild Things Are was his most well-known and most celebrated work. It is one of the most beloved children's books of all time. Today, more than 50 years after its publication, it continues to enchant children and adults alike. Where the Wild Things Are has been translated into dozens of languages, sold millions of copies around the world. It's also been made into a movie, an opera, and its style has been imitated by authors and illustrators many times over. I'm telling you all about this because a traveling exhibit featuring Maurice Sendak's work opens this weekend at the Enoch Pratt Free Library at the Central Branch in Baltimore. It's entitled 50 Years, 50 Works, 50 Reasons. The exhibit features 50 of the author's selected illustrations. With me now in Studio A at WYPR to talk about Maurice Sendak and about the exhibit is Pratt librarian Ellen Reardon, who is president of the Association for Library Service to Children. That association is responsible for awarding the Caldecott Medal annually to the most distinguished picture book for children. So, Ellen Reardon, nice to have you in the studio with me. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Dan. Nice to be here.
Yeah, good. And Ellen came with Stephen Bretso. Stephen Bretso has organized more than 200 touring exhibits and was a collaborator with Dr. Seuss himself, Ted Geisel, in putting together this first ever exhibit of Maurice Sendak's work on tours. So, Stephen Bretso, nice to have you on the Midday Show.
Nice to be here. Nice to be in Baltimore. This is great.
Yeah. Tell us about this exhibit. Would you, where it's been? It's last year was actually the 50th anniversary of Where the Wild Things Are.
That's true. And we decided it to commemorate the anniversary of the publishing, 50 years since the publishing of Where the Wild Things Are. We would gather 50 works, and we would go to 50 distinguished people in America, everybody from Whoopi Goldberg and President Obama, who, by the way, reads Where the Wild Things Are in the exhibition. And he was an easy sell. He loved doing it on the White House, in the White House garden during Easter. And Stephen Colbert and Tom Hanks and President Clinton all make some comments. And it has been touring. It's about 22 cities. It's been everywhere from the Disney Museum in San Francisco to Los Angeles and Chicago, Houston, Nashville, New York. And it continues on into 2017. It's going on to Chicago and some other cities. So it's been really popular.
Well, and it's been really popular. I mean, the reception's been good in all those cities from children and adults.
Yeah, I mean, at the risk of doing numbers, it's drawing about 50,000 people everywhere it goes. It's really fun.
That's great. Ellen, why is that book so important, Where the Wild Things Are? What would you say about it?
Where the Wild Things Are, I think, is a great example and probably the first time in picture books where the child's rich interior life is really articulated for people, that children have an imagination and that things that might be scary like monsters won't be scary when they are in control. Max is always in control of the monsters, and I think that was a really important piece. It was somewhat controversial because of its monsters, but Max remains firmly in charge, and that's why I think it exists in people's imaginations and why it resonates so strongly with them.
Millions of people have grown up with this book. This book's, as we're talking about here, 50 years, so this is the 60s generation. People born in the, what? I'm thinking now, 60s and 70s and 80s. There's a lot of folks. Now, when you watch children while this is being read to them, I wonder what is your observation about the children as this book's being read?
The children, I think, delight in Max's slightly naughty behavior. I think they also understand inherently that the monsters are on their side, which is a really nice foil to sometimes the way monsters are perceived. So I think they feel very empowered. You usually see a really positive response when you read this book.
Right. And Stephen Bretzel, can you tell us about Maurice Sendak? He died in 2012, and actually I didn't know much about him until I started reading his obituaries at that time a couple of years ago. I mean, how did he get started in this work?
Well, interestingly enough, he was born the same day as Mickey Mouse was created and was infatuated with Mickey Mouse, wrote a letter to Walt Disney when he was 7 years old and said, I want to work for you. And Walt Disney wrote back to him and said, well, call me later, kid. by the way, you know that Where the Wild Things Are wasn't actually his favorite book, which is really fascinating. His favorite book was In the Night Kitchen because he was so enamored of movies and Hollywood. It's full of Laurel and Hardy references and Charlie Chaplin references. And The Milkman's Gone Away, he had that song worm in his head constantly, and he wrote this book to the rhythm of Milkman's Gone Away. He had grown up in New York City. He was a shy kid. He was obsessed with drawing. In fact, when he was in high school, his first job was two blocks away drawing at a comic book company, the comic strip Mutt and Jeff. He would color in their shoes and their outfits. And one interesting anecdote, when he was in junior high school, he was a recalcitrant kid. He had a stutter, sat in the back of the classroom, and their final exam in English class was to present a report on Macbeth. And his teacher, a very sensitive and observant older woman, noticed that he was very uncomfortable standing in front of the class. So she called him in after class and said, Maurice, you may make your report by drawing it. And the next day he came in with eight drawings of Macbeth, and she hung them in the classroom. He didn't have to speak to the students. And when we were researching this exhibition, we found that her great-grandchildren had a trunk where they kept those original drawings from her classroom, where she had written on the back of them, A+, Maurice, you should be an artist. And those drawings are in the exhibition for the first time.
I'm sorry, Stephen. How old was he at that time?
He was about 9 years old.
9 years old. Yeah. Well, that's, and they're in the exhibition?
For the first time, yeah.
Please tell us more about the exhibition. What will people see? And Ellen, we'll tell folks about the event tomorrow. You have a big kickoff of the exhibition tomorrow at the Pratt. But what's in it?
You'll see dozens and dozens of drawings from Where the Wild Things Are. You'll see some posters. You'll see illustrations from Really Rosie. You'll see those drawings from his elementary school. You'll see a portrait that he did, a much beloved portrait he did, standing by a mirror holding the hand of Mickey Mouse. And it was in his personal collection. By the way, his studio was full of Mickey Mouse memorabilia. Hmm. And even he drew with a Mickey Mouse pen later in his life. You'll see all sorts of material referencing Where the Wild Things Are and In the Night Kitchen. But essentially, you're going to see bookmarks of all of the moments in his career that were commemorated and recognized as kind of seminal drawings that evoke his style and what he meant to kids. And the exhibition came about years ago when I was curating a show with Dr. Seuss, Ted Geisel, and I asked him, Ted, who do you think is the seminal artist working today in children's book illustration? And he said, Sendak, Sendak, Sendak. And that quote's in the exhibition. And he helped me organize the first touring exhibition of Maurice Sendak at the publication of his book of Where the Wild Things Are.
This is coming to the Pratt Library tomorrow. And the kickoff event, Ellen, want to tell folks about that?
Absolutely. It's called Imagination Celebration. It's tomorrow from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. And there will be activities for children in Central Hall. We have a performer coming in at noon, all around the celebration of the art of Maurice Sendak. And in addition to seeing the wonderful exhibition and all of the art that Steve has mentioned, in order to sort of extend the reading experience for families in Baltimore, we've recreated Max's bedroom. And
oh, wow.
You can actually go in and sit on his bed and see what he had for dinner, still warm when he gets back, and sit in a reading boat and even take an adventure like he did to Where the Wild Things Are.
That sounds great. That's Saturday at the Central Branch of the Enoch Pratt Free Library from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Now, I'm going to do something here. I'm going to put out a phone number for our listeners. I would just love to hear from a couple of people maybe in the next segment about Where the Wild Things Are, about Maurice Sendak, what that book or that artist meant to you. 410-662-8780. Any interesting stories you have to tell us about reading this book to your children or seeing it performed in school, 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. Stephen Bredsoe with us with this traveling exhibition about Maurice Sendak and the Where the Wild Things Are. And Ellen Reardon from the Central, from the Enoch Pratt Free Library. They'll be with us for a few more minutes after the break. So give us a call now if you want to share a memory or a story about Where the Wild Things Are, Maurice Sendak. A quick break now as we urge you to make a donation to WYPR. It's easy to become a member. You can pledge online at WYPR.org. And welcome back to Midday. I wanted to take a couple of phone calls here on Where the Wild Things Are and Maurice Sendak while we were being visited by Stephen Bredsoe, a curator of this touring exhibition, and Ellen Reardon from the Pratt Library. Mary in Cockeysville, go right ahead. Welcome to Midday.
Oh, yes. Well, I wanted to tell you that when my children were small, I used to read that a lot to them. And I know somebody talked about imagination. But I see it as a kind of a way that children who, with their parents, you know, telling them that they've been naughty, and they have been naughty, but they, it kind of, you know, a large person telling you, you've been bad, you've been naughty, you know, and sending them to the room is so scary to them. And I remember actually taking some of the drawings from Maurice Sendak and putting them and saying, here's the bad mother, you know, where she's shaking her finger at them. And then they can take their, because the little boy is actually doing some naughty things, you know, chasing the dog and being kind of, a Max, a terrible Max. So Max goes up to his room, and he's carried away to this land where he's in control, and he can be the grown-up, and he can, you know, he can tell them. But at the same time, he's not, you know, playing on, he's using his imagination, and he's learning how to cope.
He's learning how to cope. You made that point earlier, Ellen, about Max being in charge.
Exactly.
Right?
I think one of the interesting things about the story is the way it ends. He comes back and his dinner is there still warm.
Right.
So that very important small detail shows that he's in a still very loving family. And so all of his, it's the perfect resolution.
Steve, you said that Sendak didn't consider Where the Wild Things Are his favorite book. Did he ever talk about what was going on in his mind when he drew it and wrote it?
There's a great story about this. It was his first big book that his editor, Ursula Nordstrom, who was the queen of children's literature and an iconic figure in the history of children's books, had given him his first big assignment, and he came back to her with an idea of writing a book and drawing a book called Where the Wild Horses Are. And she thought, this is spectacular, Maurice. I can't wait to see it. And he called her 3 weeks later, and he said, Ursula, there's one big problem. I don't know how to draw horses. I can't draw horses. She said, well, you better come up with something else because it's in color. I've already got the presses. You got to come up with something. The meantime, one of his relatives from the old country had passed away, and he and his brother and sister went to the viewing, if you will, and he noticed all of his relatives who had come over from the old country, and he said they were unkempt, and their teeth were horrifying. They had hair rolling out of their noses, and they all were grabbing him, saying, I could eat you up. And he ran home, and he said, this is what it is. This is it. It's where the wild things are. The wild things are my relatives. And he loved them dearly, and he was just a little kid.
But they terrified him.
But they terrified him, and that was the origins of Where the Wild Things Are.
Take one more quick call on this. Gary in Canton, thanks for calling Midday.
Yes. In the mid-70s, for 4 years, I was a librarian at a special program called Project GATE, Gifted and Talented Education. It was for high IQ or artistically talented grade school students. And they would come to the library or media center, an education ease, frequently. The real small kids, you didn't want to teach them the card catalog and all that nonsense and reference books. So we would sit in circles on the floor. We had special pillows designed, and we would read to each other, and we encourage reading and all that sort of stuff. Every week, if we were meeting twice a week, we want to read Where the Wild Things Are. We want to read Where the Wild Things Are.
They always wanted. I'm sorry, Gary, we're out of time. I just want to tell folks again that tomorrow is Imagination Celebration 2014 at the Pratt Library. It's a kickoff event for this exhibition of Maurice Sendak's work and Where the Wild Things Are. And I'm not surprised, Gary, that kids wanted to have that book read to them week after week. Right, Ellen?
Absolutely.
Yeah, Ellen Reardon from the Pratt Library. Thanks for being here. And Steve Brezzo, it's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, thanks for bringing this exhibition to Baltimore.
Well, it's our pleasure. You know, the number three most requested tattoo amongst people of a certain age is...
Is one of the monsters?
Yeah, one
is
of the monsters.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Steve. And good luck with this exhibition.
Thanks.
We have to make a quick move here from the library to the Cineplex with three movies opening today in Baltimore, Pride, Fury, and Men, Women, and Children. With us in the studio is our midday film critic, Christopher Llewellyn Reed, from Film and Video Department at Stevenson University. Chris blogs at chrisreedfilm.com. All right, Chris, how you doing?
I'm well, Dan. How are you?
Good. Let's start with Pride.
Sure. Well, this is a film that I really enjoyed. And if, like me, you grew up with the songs of Pete Seeger played loudly and proudly in your home, then the opening credits of Pride will immediately strike a welcome chord.
Hmm.
I used to listen to Little Boxes, but here we open with Solidarity Forever. It's the over the title credits of theater director Matthew Warchus's film. He's comes from the theater but makes this terrific new film, Pride. And in the spirit of the late champion of labor rights, Pete Seeger, Pride is a movie, though contrived and overly sentimental at a few times, it will leave you profoundly moved and hopeful. It's a film that promotes the radical notion that there are other ideas worth rallying around than patriotism and fear. It's about a group of gays and lesbians in London in the 1980s during a miners' strike, a nationwide miners' strike in the UK during the Thatcherite England. And they decide to gather funds to support the miners. And, of course, many of the gays and lesbians remember being beat up by miners growing up, and many of the miners are very suspicious of gays and lesbians from London, and yet somehow they're able to come together and support each other, and that kind of solidarity between such disparate groups is what makes the film so powerful.
It's a feature film. It's not a documentary.
It's not a documentary.
But it's based loosely on the facts?
It's based loosely on the facts.
Excellent. Do we have a clip from this?
We do. This is a clip where this Welsh Union leader, Di, played by Paddy Considine, first comes to London. This group has misunderstood what LGSM stands for. So we start in the street and then move to a pub.
Guy Donovan from the Dulyse Valley. You must be Mark.
Yes, hello.
Hiya. Mike.
Steph. Hello.
John.
Nice to meet you. So, LGSM. What does that stand for, then?
You get a garbled message over the phone. I thought the L was for London. London something. I never dreamed for a moment it was L for...
Aye.
This money you've raised, that's all from gays and lesbians.
Mostly.
Right. There we are.
This is just the beginning.
Oh?
Mm-hmm.
You've got big plans. Well, I'm not going to pretend I'm not surprised. You could see that. Truth told, you're the first gays I've ever met in my life.
As far as you're aware.
That's true.
And you're the first minor I've ever met.
You like this film?
I did very much. Again, there are some things that are perhaps a little too facile in it, but when it ends and we discover how a year after these events took place, the Labour Party was able to write into their platform a statement about supporting gay and lesbian rights with the support of miners' unions, you realize sort of how amazing this story is. And
thank you, Chris. I'm glad you mentioned this one. That's Pride. The next one we want to talk about is Fury.
Fury, which I just saw last night, and it's a brutal war film. In fact, I would say one of the most brutal war films I've ever seen. It stars Brad Pitt, Shia LaBeouf, and Michael Peña, among others. Shia LaBeouf, who, of course, has been behaving strangely in public recently, but gives an amazing performance in the film, as does Brad Pitt. And it's a film about the members of a tank dubbed Fury by the crewmen who have
been... In
World War II. Takes place in 1945, towards the end of the war, with some of the most brutal fighting yet to come as the Germans refuse to surrender. It opens with this dirt-covered battlefield, which is such an apt image because this will be a movie about dirty warfare, about morally compromised characters who, though they be the heroes of the film, nevertheless sometimes behave in ways that are hard to justify. So I have a clip where we hear the men about to face their final challenge in the film when they've been ordered to hold a crossroads, but their tank breaks down right in the middle of this crossroads, and we'll hear Brad Pitt and Shia LaBeouf, among others.
Just get all right. Look, it's about to be dark. Just get on up out of here, huh? Let them pass on through.
Let's hit them woods.
Dude, Norman, go get your pack. Let's go.
We ain't never run before. I ain't running now.
What's that?
We're gonna fight it out.
We can't.
I'm gonna hold this crossroad.
What you mean you're gonna hold this? The tank's busted. The tank's f***ing busted, Top.
Yeah, you said that.
Top, what are you doing? What do you want to do? You want to sit here?
We're gonna hold this
you
crossroad.
You want to sit here? Hold off the SS battalion.
No, it's not what I want to do, but it's what we're doing.
There's five of us.
Get your fighting position.
Mount up.
Fighting position when we ain't got a tank. How are we gonna fight?
We got a cannon.
No, that don't make sense.
You
don't
stop. What are you doing?
And it turns out what he's doing, Brad Pitt, is deciding to stay in the crossroads despite near certain death. You know, you might ask yourself, do we need another World War II film? And I would say that though I asked myself that very question before seeing the film, we need this film. This is definitely a must-see war film, although brutally violent and hard to watch at times. There's a lot of gruesome shots of carnage.
Well, you warned your listeners on that. Chris, lastly, we only have maybe 30 seconds for a quickie review. Men, Women, and Children?
Oh, boy, what to say. This is a movie that takes itself so seriously, yet has so little of consequence to say. It purports to have sort of analysis of our interconnected world where we have so few actual connections, yet it's filled with just platitude after platitude. I would say it's not worth watching despite an all-star cast including Adam Sandler and Jennifer Garner. Don't bother.
But Pride and Fury, yes.
Pride and Fury, go see.
Thank you very much. Chris Reed, Christopher Llewellyn Reed, is chair and professor of the film video department at Stevenson University. All of his reviews, you can read them at length on his blog, chrisreedfilm.com. And also, he can be seen on HCC-TV, that's Howard Community College's television station, as host of the show Real Talk. Thanks again, Chris. Folks, that's the first hour of Midday. We have to wrap up now, and we have another hour coming along, so stay right there. There's another hour after the news at 1 o'clock. Before that starts, we hope you'll become a member of WYPR. So here's Midday producer Nikki Gamer.